Thank you very much for joining me. I'm Bob Franklin. This is Like It Is. We have a very interesting program coming your way today. My guest is Sue Halpern. She's the author of the book, Can't Remember What I Forgot, The Good News from the Front Lines of Memory Research. Sue is joining me via telephone. How you doing, Sue?
Great. How are you?
I'm very well. There's a point in the press release that I received from you, which is very interesting, and I'd like for you to elaborate on it for our audience. 100% of us will experience memory loss. That true?
That's right.
Well, explain that, please. How?
Sure. Memory loss is a normal part of getting older. It's just the same thing that happens when, you know, you get older, your knees kind of get creaky, your hair gets gray, your skin isn't as supple as it was. Well, those are normal parts of aging. And memory loss is also because as you get older, your brain starts to slow down. It's not as, you know, fine-tuned. The metabolism slows down, and other parts of it are just less capable of doing the tasks that they had done before.
Now, I want to get into whether or not young people have better memories than older individuals and what have you. But I'd also like to ask you to maybe delve into how does memory work in terms of the brain? How does that work?
Well, it's funny, you know, we now that we have computers, we all sort of assume that our brain kind of works like our computers, but it's not really true. When you live your life, all sorts of things come at you, all sorts of information, like you hear things, or, you know, you see things, smell things, all your senses are engaged all the time. And your brain basically has to take all that information in and very, you know, instantaneously decide what's important and what's not. So there's a part of your brain called the hippocampus, which is kind of the gatekeeper of all that information. If it even gets in, then it gets processed in a different part of your brain, which is called the prefrontal cortex. And that at that point, you decide by how important that information is to you, by, say, how much attention you pay to it, whether that goes into short-term or long-term memory. And then it gets kind of distributed around your brain in chemical traces, just in bits and pieces. And that's why sometimes when you're thinking about something, you know, let's just say you remember that you were somewhere on a particular day, but you can't remember who was with you. But then you remember some part of that day, and you sort of reconstruct the day from all these different pieces, and they finally start to come back to you.
Is it safe to say that the older you get, the less ability to retain memory you'll have, or is that just a myth?
It's sort of a myth. It's really interesting. What happens is that, you know, all that stuff that you remembered from way back when is still there. It's, you know, it's sort of been cataloged and it exists. But what happens is that gatekeeper that I told you about, the hippocampus, doesn't function as well. And the other part I mentioned, the prefrontal cortex, also doesn't function as well. You're not able to remove distractions as easily. So what happens is that as you get older, your short-term memory starts to kind of go on the blink. Your long-term memory is pretty fine. And that's why older people sometimes don't remember, say, what they had for lunch, or that they had lunch, or that they just talked to, you know, someone 5 minutes ago, but they can remember, you know, a conversation from 20 years ago. It's because that all those mechanisms that allow short-term memory to occur are just not functioning quite as well. So, but the other thing is for older people tend to have better vocabularies than younger people. So they remember word meanings better, and they tend to have a kind of broader emotional set of memories than young people. So it's not all bad in any way.
Well, speaking of bad, as we forget things, as older we get, should we be worried about any? Can we determine, or should we take that to mean some signs of dementia or something even worse as we seemingly get old, as we get older and we seemingly forget things from time to time? Are those signals or just natural occurrences to your point of view?
Yeah, they're not necessarily bad things. Nine times out of 10, literally, they're just part of, you know, getting older. Just, you know, things that you actually, when you were younger, wouldn't give you a pause. Like, you know, if you forget your jacket when you're a teenager or your cell phone or, you know, you leave it behind or whatever, you don't automatically think, oh, my goodness, I have Alzheimer's disease. You just think, oh, gosh, I was just incredibly stupid or, you know, I wasn't paying attention. And, you know, every junior high school around the country has a huge lost and found, not because people are having, you know, serious memory problems, but they're not, you know, focused. And that's true for most of us in most of the time. So, you know, the standard line from the Alzheimer's Association is if you lose your keys, that's one thing, and that's okay. But if you can't remember what your keys are for, that's not okay. And it's that difference that would should make you worry.
Are there things that we can do to help massage our memory, our brain, so that we are so that it's as sharp as it possibly can be? Are there exercises, ballroom dancing, or crossword puzzles that you could suggest as a result of your research?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting. It turns out in that part of the brain that I mentioned before, the hippocampus, which is the gatekeeper, it produces all through your life. It produces new brain cells. It's just a another function of living. And what happens as you get older is that production of the new brain cells slows down, and that's one of the reasons why your memory isn't quite as good. Your short-term memory isn't quite as good as you get older. But recent findings have shown that if you do aerobic exercise, so exercise that gets your heart rate up, you can actually increase the production of new neurons. So you can boost that. You can get it back to where it had been when you were younger. And that automatically has been shown to have immediate benefits in memory. So people who exercised were given memory tests before they did this 12-week exercise protocol and then at the end. And those who exercised did better on their memory tests, and those who exercised the most did the best. That's amazing.
It really is. Exercise, cardiovascular exercises is certainly very good for us and for memory. This is something new for me to know, to learn on our program today. I'm Bob Franklin. You're listening to the Public Affairs Program, Like It Is. My guest is Sue Halpern. She's the author of the book, Can't Remember What I Forgot, The Good News from the Front Lines of Memory Research. Ms. Halpern, I want to ask you, is it harder to remember good events versus bad events?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And I actually don't know, you know, really, except for this. I just did a story about post-traumatic stress syndrome for the New Yorker magazine. So I talked to a lot of people who obviously have had some pretty bad memories. And those memories obviously, you know, have a big resonance in your brain when, you know, awful things happen. But when good things happen, they also have a big resonance in your brain. You know, you pay attention. You really do focus. And it's just that they don't have the kind of mirrored effect. With a traumatic memory, what happens is you remember it, but then a lot of other things trigger that memory and so reinforce it in a bad way. With good memories, it doesn't tend to happen that way. But I don't know that you could sort of say that as a consequence, a good memory isn't as strong as a bad memory.
Are there any hard memories or bad memories versus good memories that you yourself have tried to suppress or get rid of?
That's a good question. You know, I don't think so. But I was actually thinking yesterday about how, you know, how like if you have a car accident, and then it makes you afraid to go out and drive again. It's not like you say to yourself, oh, you know, I'm reliving that moment over and over again. You do that. But what happens sometimes is then you can't go out and do the things you need to do to sort of get on with your daily life. And it's those, I think, that are kind of worthy of trying to suppress. Just sort of say to yourself, wait a minute, you know, I'm kind of thinking about this in the wrong way. I'm going about this in the wrong way. But, you know, suppressing memory itself is probably not a great idea, even for traumatic memory, because it doesn't do you any good. The, you know, a better thing is actually, I know this is sounding kind of odd, but to confront it, to deal with it, and to sort of get beyond it rather than repressing it, where it tends to have a lot of power.
That's a good point, and it was leading me into the follow-up. And that's the 9/11 event. After that occurred, many of us, I will speak for myself, very frightened about getting on airplanes, very, very traumatized when an airplane was flying overhead. The suppression of that, how do you move from getting beyond that particular traumatic event to just having a normal type of occurrence, a brain occurrence, memory occurrence?
One of the things that I did in my research was I talked to people actually about this in New York City who spent a lot of time dealing with firefighters and some of the rescue workers and people who worked actually in the trade centers, who obviously, you know, had a very direct relationship to these things. And the only way that they could get better was by talking it through over and over again, sort of discussing what their fears were, and trying to sort out the rational from the irrational. So, you know, looking at a plane overhead and saying, okay, it's just a plane overhead. It's, you know, nothing bad is going to happen. And trying to, I mean, this is what a really skilled therapist can do, is help you reorganize your thinking so that you kind of separate out the thoughts that are really unproductive from the thoughts that are real and true. But it's a challenging, profession for a therapist to sort of have to do that with someone. And it doesn't always work, but the therapist I talked to actually had a lot of success. And basically it's like retraining your brain, to understand what it's doing. So it's almost like your brain is interrogating itself.
You spoke about soldiers' post-traumatic stress disorder, soldiers returning from Iraq, the memories of that hellish event over there in Iraq. How does that impact memory? And did you what were some of your research findings into that particular topic on post-traumatic stress disorders?
Well, first of all, it's a hugely difficult syndrome or disease, whatever we're going to call it, to diagnose. And for a couple reasons. One is just because it's kind of all over the map. People have lots of different symptoms. Sometimes it looks like depression. And sometimes it is, tied up with depression. So it can be hard for a therapist or a doctor to diagnose. The other thing is, of course, particularly dealing with soldiers, their resources are somewhat limited. It takes 6 months to get a diagnosis at the VA, and that's if you're lucky. So, there are a lot of people out there who have a lot of symptoms of PTSD, but they're not diagnosed, and therefore they're not treated, and that's not a good thing. Just because it has all sorts of ramifications, not just for the person, but for their family and their community. So that's sort of just one thing. It's just we're in a hard moment right now with so many soldiers coming back and needing, mental health services and not being able to get them. Then we've got, the people who are getting treated, and a lot of the treatments that are out there haven't really been proved to be that effective. And a lot of times the symptoms are being treated and not the root cause. And basically there was a study done by the what's called the Institute of Medicine last year, which is a kind of quasi-governmental agency, and they looked at all the research on treatments for post-traumatic stress syndrome, and only one treatment has been proved in a clinical way to have validity, and that's a kind of treatment called exposure therapy, and that treatment isn't done that much. But exposure therapy basically asks the soldier to talk through the event over and over and over again to the point where it loses its power, but only through in a very structured environment with a therapist. It's not something like you could just go talk to your wife or you could talk to your best friend or something. It's got to be done in a very guided way. But it's been shown to have great clinical value. So hopefully with that study in hand, the people who are training therapists to deal with people coming back from Iraq and from Afghanistan will start using that therapy more than they'll than say a more traditional, say, group, you know, a group therapy setting, which turns out not to be that helpful.
Your book is quite helpful. I've read it and will certainly suggest it to others to do so. I'm curious to know, why did you write the book? What propelled you to, or compelled you to do the research and write this book? And tell us about a little bit of your research technique as well.
Okay. Well, let me say that when I started out thinking about writing this book, I didn't actually think it would be quite as hard as it would, but it was pretty hard. And I started for two reasons. One was just because it seemed to me that everyone around me was worried about their memory, but no one really knew anything. You know, people thought things like, well, maybe the fact that I can't remember where my keys are right now means that, you know, 10 years from now, I'll definitely have Alzheimer's disease, stuff like that, where people just had kind of fears that they didn't really know how to address. And then my own father got sick, and he had some kind of dementia that the doctor said probably wasn't Alzheimer's disease, but they couldn't say that for sure, which I found very frustrating. For all sorts of reasons. You know, one is you want to know what's wrong, and the other is Alzheimer's tends to run in families, so, you know, at the very least, you'd kind of want to know if that's in your medical history. So that was going on. In order to do the research, I first of all kind of parked myself at a academic medical setting. I went to Columbia University, and there's a place there called the Taub Center for Research on Alzheimer's and the Aging Brain. And I just kind of hung out there for about 4 years with the doctors, with the scientists, with the therapists, with the social workers, with the genetic counselors, with everybody. And just, you know, I was there so long, they think they forgot that I was, you know, actually not part of their staff. And therefore, they let me go off with them when they did their research in the community. They let me go into the lab. They let me, you know, basically I had free rein. So that was really terrific. And then I also decided that it would be really important to put myself through the kinds of tests that people go through when they're worried about their memory. And those include things like a PET scan where they inject you with a radioactive dye and then they put you in a machine and they take a picture of your brain, and various kinds of MRIs, some where you're just lying there and they're just, you know, it's just real noisy and you're lying in the magnet, it's kind of boring, or where they actually have you do a task, like remember lists of words while you're lying there perfectly still, and all those sorts of things. And then I did a series of what are called neuropsychological tests, and those are the tests that if you are worried about your memory and if your physician or someone in your family thinks that you really have a problem or you think you have a problem, you go to a psychologist and they give you these tests. They take 4, 5, 6 hours, depending on which, you know, battery they give you. And they get a really good picture of your brain in as it functions. So, you know, your math skills or your spatial reasoning skills. And it's all one big picture made up of little pictures as you go along. And it's pretty interesting. I mean, if you're terrified while you're doing it, it's going to affect the outcome. But if you're like me, you're sort of doing it because you were curious about it. It was pretty extraordinary experience, and I learned a lot about myself when I was doing it.
Well, you know, I was reading in your book, and I was surprised at the role that sleep plays in memory disruption. Would you talk a little bit about that, sleep deprivation?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. You know, we know that sleep is really important for all sorts of things. And one of the things it's important for, we know about, is, you know, sort of like the repair, the cellular repair of your body. But it's also really important for the kind of reorganization of your brain. So, you know, one of the ways they torture people is by keeping them up all night, and it's because eventually your brain gets so scrambled it can't really work. It no longer functions properly. So the flip side of that is that you really need to sleep for your brain to just kind of settle down, reorganize, and repair itself as well. The government, our government, does a lot of research into sleep deprivation, in part because we have soldiers, pilots, who are often called upon to do tasks where they have a serious sleep deprivation. And the government's interest is in trying to figure out what that effect is, you know, cognitively, what happens to your brain when you don't sleep, and then what can you do to overcome that. And, of course, you know, most of their ways of doing that are through medications. But for most of us, a better answer is to actually just get enough sleep.
Well, earlier you mentioned exercise, and now we're talking about getting a proper sleep. That's two good take-home points there. Also, reading your book, I was encouraged. I think older individuals who read this book will be encouraged, because I'm reading from page 80, and it says, according to the authors of the John Hopkins White Paper on Memory, quote, study repeatedly show that older people who do poorly on time tests actually do as well or better than their college-aged counterparts when they are permitted to work at their own pace.
Exactly.
The machinery was slow, but it worked. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, as I said earlier, your brain, the metabolism of your brain slows down. But that doesn't mean that you're not capable anymore. It just means you are doing stuff slower. It's the same when, you know how when you're driving and you're younger, your reflexes are really, really quick. And when you're older, they're not quite as quick. They're still there. And it's the same thing with your memory. And the fact is, most tasks aren't timed. You know, we go through our lives and you know, we're perfectly capable. It's just that one of the issues, I suppose, in our culture is everything happens, you know, quick. But, you know, if you understand kind of what your capacities are, I think it sort of makes you feel a lot calmer about what's going on. And if you know that, you know, say your vocabulary is better than younger people, or you actually are just as capable as they are, I think that gives you a certain confidence, which in and of itself helps your memory, because you're not distracted by the thought that, oh my goodness, I can't do this. You sort of reduce a certain level of stress just by having that confidence. And that's one of the things that I came away with doing the research, and that I hope people reading the book will come away with, is a sense that people are really capable, and there are things that they can do. And then, you know, older people actually, you know, there's one guy I write about who has a really compelling theory about how older people's brains work differently because they're wiser than younger people, which I think has a lot of validity to it as well.
Some of the things
you can show it in a brain scanner, which is kind of cool.
So some of the things that they can do, I mentioned earlier, ballroom dancing, crossword puzzles. But is it safe to say if you don't use it, you'll lose it regarding to memory?
Yes, I think that's safe to say. But there's sort of two things going on. You have to have intellectual, mental stimulation. That's crucial. Just as it is, you know, I mean, otherwise you can kind of curl up and die, and that would be bad. So that's important. But it's not gonna like prevent necessarily a disease. It could slow it down, and that's really important. Alzheimer's in particular is a disease of very old people, typically. I mean, you know, if you're 85, you have a really good chance of having Alzheimer's. If you're 65, you maybe have a 1 in 10 chance of getting Alzheimer's, which sounds bad, but it's, you know, 9 out of 10 aren't going to have it. So, you know, if you flip the statistic, you have to feel pretty good about it. So use it or lose it is important. And there are people who do research that I write about why it is important for your brain. But the most important thing, or as, you know, exercise is probably more important. Physical exercise is probably more important than that, although one wouldn't want to have to choose between the two. But the other thing, the other component that's really crucial is a social component. So people who are isolated don't do as well as people who have a social part of their life. So one thing I say to people is, you know, if it's a choice between staying home in your house and doing a crossword puzzle and going to your church or VFW or whatever, you know, place in your community and playing bingo, go play bingo, because it's got that social component, which in and of itself is a very stimulating part of your life.
So being isolated and being lonely and away distant from others could actually help to accelerate a person's illness, if not their health status.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there's a large connection between memory problems and depression, and there's a connection between depression and isolation. So it sort of stands to reason that if you get yourself out of that isolated situation and into a social situation, you're automatically kind of giving yourself a boost, because you're confronting one of the problems, you know, that causes depression, and that in and of itself causes memory loss. So, you know, getting out of the house, getting involved with other people, however you do that, is a really, really important part of keeping healthy.
We're running toward the end of our program. Maybe one more question to my guest, Sue Halpern. She's the author of the book, Can't Remember What I Forgot. Let me ask you, Sue, what do you remember as the most provocative or compelling part of your research in doing this book?
Wow, that's a question. One of the things that happened in the very beginning, the very first time I got my brain scanned, was I was really scared. I didn't know what they would find. And I remember lying there just thinking, you know, these people who are looking right now on their computer screens at my brain, which is in my body, know more about me than I do. They know more about my future than I do. And it was a really, really disconcerting moment that I don't think I'll ever forget.
That's a great answer. That's a great answer. My guest today has been Sue Halpern. She's the author of the book, Can't Remember What I Forgot, The Good News from the Front Lines of Memory Research. Sue, I want to thank you for being a guest today on Like It Is.
Thank you so much, Dr. Franklin.
I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.